All right, so we're diving deep today into a case that really grabs you by the collar. It's Jordan v. Mayfull. And yeah, it's got that celebrity sizzle. It's Michael Jordan after all, but peel back the fame, and what we've got here is a legal tug of war with contract law at its heart, right at the core, and then layered on top, public policy questions that are anything but slam dunks. We're going to tackle this question: can you actually pay someone to zip it? Legally speaking, is that a legit settlement, or does it cross the line into something shady, something like extortion? I mean, NDAs and settlement agreements, they're everywhere in law, so where those boundaries are, that's what we're unpacking today.
Totally. What's so gripping about this case is that it's got these huge names attached to it, right?
Yeah.
But when you really dig in, it all boils down to these fundamental legal concepts that every single law student out there is wrestling with. It's like taking everything you're learning about contract law and throwing it into this real-life pressure cooker. We're not just asking, do they have a deal? We're asking, why? And what does that why tell us about our legal system?
So let's map this out, the core of the dispute. We've got Michael Jordan on one side, Carla NFL on the other. And Mayfull, she's claiming that Jordan promised her, wait for it, $5 million upon his retirement. Now, the trade-off, the condition for that big payout, silence about their affair. And no paternity suit regarding her child, who she believed at the time Jordan was the father of.
That's the starting point, yeah. And Jordan, he actually did pay NFL $250,000. But the story takes a turn because Mayfull says that money, that was for the emotional roller coaster, the stress, the heartache. Then some time passes and she comes back saying, hey, where's the rest of my $5 million? We had a deal.
And that's where Jordan steps in and basically says, whoa, hold up, $5 million. Never promised that. No such agreement. But he doesn't stop there. He brings out the legal big guns, saying even if we entertain the idea that there was some kind of agreement, it wouldn't fly in court. Extortion, lack of consideration, that's lawyer speak, for no real exchange of value, plus it wasn't even written down, which sometimes is a no-go under the statute of frauds. And oh, by the way, way too much time has passed, so it's barred by the statute of limitations. He's pulling out every legal argument in the book.
Oh, absolutely. He came prepared. And Mayfull, she wasn't backing down either. She fires back with a countersuit saying, you broke the contract, Jordan. You owe me the full $5 million. And that, my friend, is how our legal drama begins right in the trial court.
Okay, so we've got this legal showdown brewing, claims flying back and forth. What did the trial court make of all this?
Well, the trial court, they decided to do a little simplifying. They tossed out both Jordan's initial lawsuit and Mayfull's counterclaim, their reasoning. They went straight for the jugular, saying this alleged agreement, that's extortion, not enforceable, case closed. And then they went a step further, stating that there wasn't even a genuine legal beef, an actual controversy in legal terms, with Jordan's request for the court to just nullify the alleged agreement.
Extortion, just like that. That's a pretty strong stance. So that's the end of the story, right? Not so fast. What happened next?
Well, Mayfull, she wasn't ready to throw in the towel. She wasn't going to let them just dismiss her counterclaim. So she takes it up the ladder, straight to the appellate court. And this is where things take a really interesting turn. The appellate court, they hit the brakes. They reversed the trial court's decision. And their message was basically, hold on, we need to pump the brakes and dig into the facts here. The $1 million question, or should I say $5 million question, driving this whole reversal. Can paying for silence ever be a legitimate way to settle a legal issue? Or does it automatically fall under the extortion umbrella? That's the crux of the appeal.
That makes a lot of sense. I mean, at first glance, paying someone to stay quiet, it does raise some red flags. But like the appellate court pointed out, the devil's in the details. The context surrounding the agreement is key.
Precisely. It's not a black and white situation. Agreements that involve keeping something hush-hush, they're not automatically labeled as extortion. The court really stressed looking at the bigger picture. Was there an actual legitimate issue at play, like Mayfull's potential paternity claim? Was there any pressure, any coercion involved? And this is big. Was the goal of the agreement to sweep some crime under the rug?
And wasn't it Justice Thays who really spelled this out in the appellate court's opinion? The idea that if Mayfull genuinely had reason to believe Jordan was her child's father, then their agreement, her promise not to take him to court for paternity in exchange for money, could be seen as a legitimate way to settle that potential claim and not necessarily extortion.
Spot on. The appellate court essentially laid out a sort of informal checklist. Look for a clear link between the agreement and a plausible legal claim. Make sure there was no coercion, no undue influence when they made the deal. And finally, check that the main goal wasn't to hide some criminal activity. So Just because an agreement involves keeping things quiet, that alone doesn't make it illegal.
So the trial court, they also tossed out Jordan's request for what they call a declaratory judgment, saying no actual controversy existed. So what is that, a declaratory judgment, and why did the appellate court see it differently? You can think of it like Jordan wanting the court to officially stamp invalid on the alleged agreement, like a legal preemptive strike.
That's a great way to put it. And the appellate court, they weren't on board with the trial court here. They basically said, look, NAFL's counterclaim for breach of contract, that creates a very real active legal battle. By saying Jordan broke their agreement, NAFL put the whole question of whether that agreement even existed and whether it was legal right on the court's doorstep. So the appellate court said there's definitely something to argue about here, a genuine controversy that needs a legal resolution.
So the takeaway here, courts, they can't just shy away from legal questions when the parties are locked in a real legal fight, throwing punches with opposing claims. The whole point of the system is to provide a resolution.
Absolutely. It underscores the role of the courts, stepping in, resolving real legal disputes. Now, let's get a bit more granular here and unpack some basic contract law concepts that are swirling around in this case, specifically consideration and public policy.
Okay, so consideration. In the world of contracts, that's all about value, right? What could NAFL have offered Jordan that would be considered legit consideration, that exchange of value in return for his alleged $5 million promise?
In this case, the most likely form of consideration, NAFL's promise not to hit Jordan with a paternity lawsuit. If she truly believed in good faith that he was the father, her agreement to give up that legal right to not sue, to forbear, could be seen as valid consideration. She's giving up something potentially valuable in exchange for the money.
Makes sense. It's a specific legal action she's agreeing to hold back on. But then we've got Jordan arguing that NAFL already had a legal obligation not to defame him, so her promise to stay silent wasn't really giving him anything new in the eyes of the law. What about that?
That's a sharp observation, and the court did address this indirectly. If you already have a legal duty to do something, or to not do something, that usually doesn't count as fresh, new value for a brand new contract.
Yeah.
So NAFL's existing duty not to badmouth Jordan, that wouldn't be considered new value. But the potential paternity suit, that's different. That's a new legal avenue she could have pursued, but allegedly agreed to drop as part of this deal. Think of it like this. Staying quiet about the affair itself might be tied to her existing duty not to defame, but the agreement not to file a paternity suit, which could be costly and very public, that's a separate commitment, a new promise.
That's a really important distinction, the pre-existing duty versus the new promise regarding the paternity suit. That's key to understanding the consideration piece of the puzzle. All right, now let's bring in public policy in Illinois. How does that factor into this legal equation?
Public policy. It's like a lens that courts use to examine contracts. It's a big deal. Most places, Illinois included, really like the idea that people should be free to make agreements. But that freedom, it has boundaries. If a contract is seen as harmful to society, to the public interest, it can be thrown out, voided, deemed against public policy.
So where's the line in the sand? When does an agreement, especially one about keeping secrets and especially involving someone famous, when does that go from being a private matter to something that's bad for the public and therefore unenforceable?
That's the tricky part. It's about finding the right balance. The courts have to weigh the right to privacy, the ability to settle disputes quietly, against the public's interest in transparency, in knowing what's going on, and in preventing deals that might be coercive or take advantage of someone. Things get murky when the agreement looks like it's designed to cover up wrongdoing or silence someone who has a legitimate claim or information that the public should know about. In Jordan v. NAFL, the court was essentially asking, was this agreement a legitimate way to handle a private matter? Or was it an attempt to use money to silence someone, potentially shielding Jordan from scrutiny, from legal accountability?
And in the end, what did the appellate court actually decide? What was their holding?
They didn't deliver a final verdict on the contract's validity. Instead, they acknowledged that these huge factual questions were still hanging in the air. Was there pressure on NAFL? Did she have real grounds for a paternity claim? So they decided to send both Jordan's initial lawsuit and NAFL's countersuit back to the trial court.
A legal rematch, back to square one for a closer look at the facts, right?
Exactly. The case was remanded back to the trial court with a clear directive. Figure out the facts. This really highlights an important point about our legal system. Appellate courts, They don't usually dive into factual disputes. Hmm. They're more like referees, making sure the lower court played by the rules, applied the law correctly. If there are big factual questions, those usually need to be hashed out in a trial with evidence, with witnesses.
It makes sense. You can't really decide if the agreement was legal without knowing the full story. So for all the future lawyers out there listening, what can we learn from this case, practically speaking?
Several things stand out. When you're drafting confidentiality clauses in settlement agreements or advising clients about them, tie them to a legitimate legal claim. That makes them much stronger, more likely to be enforced. Second, public figures. They shouldn't just assume that any agreement where someone agrees to stay quiet will automatically be tossed out as against public policy. The details, the specifics of the dispute, that's what matters.
And if you're going to argue that an agreement is extortion, you can't just say it right. You need to back it up. Evidence of coercion, of pressure, that's what's going to make the case.
Right on. The appellate court sending it back for a factual review. That really drives home the importance of evidence. Just making claims in a complaint or motion, that's often not enough to get a case dismissed early on, especially if the agreement has some plausible basis in good faith. And don't forget, the fact that Jordan paid Neffel that $250,000 allegedly for her suffering, that could actually hurt his argument that there was no agreement at all. It suggests there was some kind of exchange happening.
All right, so what's the big picture here? Jordan v. Neffel, it throws a spotlight on the idea that agreeing to keep quiet, it's not always a straightforward thing. It can have all these legal wrinkles, especially when you bring in potential legal claims and the whole idea of public policy. It really makes you stop and think. What's the difference between a legitimate settlement where you're trying to resolve a potential problem and an agreement that's basically hush money that's maybe coercive or harmful to the public? Something for all of us to consider as we move forward in our legal journeys. As you're working with clients, how are you going to handle these sensitive situations? What factors are going to be at the top of your list when you're trying to figure out if one of these agreements will hold up in court? A lot to think about.
It also raises a broader question, something to ponder as you go deeper into the world of law. How does our legal system and society in general strike that delicate balance between wanting privacy, wanting to settle disputes without a big public spectacle, and the need for transparency, accountability, especially when you're dealing with powerful people, public figures? It's a tension you'll see again and again across many areas of law. Jordan v. Neffel, it's a really fascinating case study in that balancing act.
So much to unpack. This is definitely a case that stays with you. And it reminds us, like you said, that law, it's not just about rules on paper. It's about people. It's about power. It's about how we navigate these gray areas. Thanks for taking this deep dive with us today.
Absolutely. It's these messy, real-life cases that really make the law come alive.
Until next time, keep those legal minds sharp. And remember, the law is all around us.
We'll see you next time for another deep dive.